The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 4.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
I've got a very special guest today, folks. It's Jeff Deist, president of the Mises Institute. Jeff and I, well, that's how we know each other. I was affiliated with the Mises Institute, and then it was also under his leadership that I became a senior fellow with the Mises Institute. So glad to be working with and a colleague of Jeff's in that respect. Just a little bit more about his background. He is a writer, public speaker, and advocate for property markets and civil society. Jeff previously worked as a longtime advisor and chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul. And in his years with Dr. Paul, Jeff worked with countless grassroots activists and organizations dedicated to reducing the size and scope of government. Also, and we're going to get into this in my interview with Jeff, he has spent many years as a tax attorney advising private equity clients on mergers and acquisitions. So with that official introduction, let's now jump into my interview with Jeff Deist. Well, Jeff, it's a pleasure to have you here on the fourth episode of the Bob Murphy Show. Welcome.
The fourth episode. Wow. Thanks very much, Bob.
Yes. Yeah, there's only three other things that I thought were more important than you. So you just, when you're, you know,
okay,
pondering your life accomplishments, that's one of the things you can store away there.
Gee whiz. Thanks very much, Bob.
So as people now are gathering who are listening to this new podcast, what I try to do when I have somebody who's in a well-known figure, I want to be the podcast that I want to hear in the world, taking Gandhi's advice. And so I always want to know more about the people that are in the limelight, as it were. So if we could start, I know just reading your standard descriptions, it says you originally were a tax attorney. And so I'm wondering, can you just tell us a little bit about that? And, you know, how did you get in that career path?
Well, I wish it was more noble. It wasn't very noble. In the early 1990s in California, I very much wanted to be a PhD professor, believe it or not. And not just a professor, but a professor of literature,
oh, wow,
which had been my background. I was an English major and very much like words and language and linguistics.
Did you
and
have
rhetoric.
The best words like Trump?
Well, you know, but what started to be known was that there was a glut of PhDs. And all of a sudden, even as far ago as the early 90s, we started to hear this sort of filtered down information about people with PhDs not necessarily getting jobs because, if you recall, we all imagined we'd live in some leafy bucolic town and have a really easy schedule and ponder things and read books all day. And as it turns out, there were an awful lot of people already in California that far back who were really having to cobble together an academic career by driving around to various community colleges, teach a huge load of classes. They weren't being paid very much for those classes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I started to rethink that and I said, well, I don't want to be poor. And so I started to look more and more at law school as a, you know, and first and foremost, to not be poor. And second of all, to combine my already strong interest in libertarianism with tax, because I felt like, gee whiz, if your client is a taxpayer, he or she is always innocent. There's no such thing as cheating on your taxes, and there's no such thing as owing taxes, at least in my worldview, of course. And so it seemed like, unlike litigation or criminal law or other things, it was kind of the two parties were at each other's throats, and really it was all about churning and making billable hours. So here I thought this might be an opportunity to do something where I feel happy about it, and also I can make a decent living. So that's sort of the banal reality of it. I wish it was more interesting than that, Bob.
Had you considered like being a defense attorney, or was that not in your skill set?
You know, I hadn't. And again, that's noble, because regardless of what someone has done in a factual sense, I don't think the state or the state of California or the San Diego County or whatever entity you're looking at is in any moral or ethical position to be prosecuting anyone or punishing anyone. So, but it's a really tough life. There are an awful lot of defense attorneys, former prosecutors, and moreover, it's a very rough clientele. And from what I've heard, of course, when you've got a criminal client, you better get as much of your money up front because lo and behold, if you should fail to get him or her acquitted, they're not likely to be responding to your bills from the pokey. So it just seemed like a tougher life. And frankly, in tax law, there's a special degree you can get called an LLM, a Master's of Law, which is sort of an additional year of law school. And just like with the PhD glut, I was very concerned about the lawyer glut. We were hearing a lot about that. There were plenty of attorneys who weren't necessarily getting good jobs or partner track positions in law firms, et cetera. So it seemed like a way to distinguish myself. But no, I didn't really consider criminal. And I have some friends who have gone into it, who did go into it or are still doing it. And I will say some of them do very well.
Well, just I remember when I was like kind of like a little kid, even like before I was into libertarianism, I always did think it was a neat aspect of at least what America was supposed to be, that everybody gets a trial. So like even, in other words, like I respected people who would be defense attorneys, even for somebody they thought was guilty, not trying to get the person off, but just to like make sure we don't railroad somebody. Like, okay, if the person's guilty, then the system should reach that conclusion. Obviously, now I'm much more cynical and all that, but I do remember thinking that a defense attorney was a noble thing back then, just to make sure everybody got their day in court, sort of thing. Let me ask: Are there things about tax law, like for example, and you don't have to name names, but do you ever see economists talking about the tax code from a economistic-y perspective when you know that actually there's a lot of nuances or things that we just don't get right because we're not we weren't in the trenches with it?
Well, economists tend to miss the detail in tax. They tend to look at the big picture, and the devil is really in the detail. We can't imagine that members of Congress have some expertise to write tax laws. They don't. The tax code that we have is this cobbled together thing that's been glommed onto and excised in parts over many, many years. And of course, there was a big Reform Act of 86 when Reagan was president, which forms still, even with the Trump tax bill, still forms sort of the core of the modern Internal Revenue Code. So what economists don't understand is that it's really more about the gritty details than about some overarching principles in tax. It's easy to say certain, a capital gains tax kills incentives for capital accumulation. It's easy to say those kind of things. But I think sometimes economists overestimate the degree to which tax is a driver in decisions. I fell into mergers and acquisitions simply because that was a really booming go-go period throughout the 90s and 2000s when I was practicing. And I will say it was a go-go period very much because of Alan Greenspan and then later Ben Bernanke. When you force interest rates below what we would argue is their natural rate, when the cost of borrowing money is cheap, there's a lot more deal activity. A lot more companies get bought and sold because the private equity firms, whom I represented mostly, are sort of playing with house money. They're just putting a little bit of their own equity, their own cash that they've built up over the years from other investments, into buying a company, and they're using several parts of debt. So at the peak of the M&A boom, let's say in the mid-2000s before the big crash, we'd often see deals where a company was purchased with just, let's say, one part equity to seven or eight or even more parts debt. And that debt would get sliced up into multiple tranches. And the reason for this is really pretty simple, is that when a company pays off its creditors, the interest payments are tax deductible within limits. There are some limits on high yield or really high interest rate debt where you can't deduct the full payment. But for the most part, when companies pay interest, that's a tax deduction. When companies pay dividends, it generally isn't. So here's an example where tax really is a driver of how business acquisitions are structured. And so I saw a lot of deals where things were really out of whack. The amount that just the dollar amount that people, the private equity companies were paying for companies, sometimes 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 times earnings, always seemed very out of whack to me. And of course, it was out of whack because of the Fed. So it was interesting how my my work in tax sort of dovetailed with what was going on with the Fed and created a real interest in me when it comes to money and monetary policy. And of course, knowing Ron Paul over the years and working for Ron Paul briefly really lent itself to that. So I hope that there's been some cohesion in all of it. I hope so. I've learned some lessons anyway.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, were you in that environment then, like when like the Tyco scandal, all that stuff that led to Sarbanes-Oxley, like were you in the sector at that point?
Yeah, and Sarbanes-Oxley is a very big deal. People don't understand how much of a big deal it was. It created a whole level of criminal liability, potential criminal liability at the CEO suite level, which has a very chilling effect, and it has a very bad effect on business when it comes to, I would argue, risk-taking and product development and all kinds of things. But here's the other thing, is that up until the Enron fiasco and the Arthur Andersen implosion in the early 2000s, what was then called the Banking Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives was really considered a sleepy backwater committee. And that's one of the reasons they didn't complain when Ron Paul asked for it. They said, okay, fine, we'll stick Ron Paul over the Banking Committee. You can talk about the Fed, but no one cares. And that was largely true. Even amongst professional economists, monetary economics and central banking was sort of considered this dull, backwater area of specialization. It wasn't really sexy. It wasn't really political. And that, you know, the action was in the bond markets or wherever it might be. And all that changed around that period of Enron and Arthur Andersen and Sarbanes-Oxley, sort of that 2001, 2002 period. And all of a sudden, the Banking Committee, Bob, became the Financial Services Committee. And all of a sudden, these big-time regulations were being passed pretty quickly because just like after 9/11, Congress wanted to look like it was doing something after the dot-com bust and Enron and all those kinds of things. And so a lot of stuff got rushed through that has a really serious impact, if nothing else, forget the bad incentives, it were just a compliance burden of Sarbanes-Oxley. They might as well call it the Full Accountants Employment Act, because it created umpteen million billable hours for what is now, after Arthur Andersen, only four big accounting firms left in the United States. So it was a big deal, and it turned the Banking Committee into the Financial Service Committee, into something where the chairman or chairperson of that committee could go on to riches in the financial industry afterwards. And I'm sure we've seen that with a few different chairs since then. So it was an interesting time. And it was also a time where I think America lost a lot of its innocence about corporate America, that there was a lot of phony baloney accounting going on, a lot of debt being hidden in creative ways on balance sheets. And really, it left a lot of people, I think, with the correct conclusion that the average guy or gal is going to have a hard time as an investor. It's even with all this regulatory framework, we think of the SEC, it really just lulls us into a false sense of security, a sense that, well, these markets are regulated, right? So I better invest my money every month, just like Bob Brinker tells me, dollar cost averaging, or just like Dave Ramsey tells me, because gee whiz, the stock market returns X percentage over time if we just stay in there. I think that that kind of thinking got shaken in that period. And, you know, being inside a lot of private equity deals and seeing a lot of private equity firms up close, For as hard as they worked, these were some cowboy people. I definitely worked with some people who had pieces of the various funds they worked with as part of their compensation package, and whose mentality was that I'm going to be a multimillionaire at 30, or I'm going to be a multimillionaire at 35. There wasn't a sense of, you know, we are involved in, our goal is to reallocate capital to its best and highest uses and thus benefit society. No, that was not what was going on in the go-go days of private equity. The goal was to buy a company, load it down with debt, kill the management, make some big sweeping changes, install your own private equity guys on the board, and turn around and sell it in 3 to 5 years. So that was the model. And it was an eye-opening experience, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I've just anecdotally, just knowing various people that I went to high school with or knew vaguely through social circles and then seeing where they ended up, I mean, people who were ambitious and liked wielding power would go to Washington or go into politics. And the people who just wanted to be rich, like, you know, they would go into the financial sector. And, you know, and certainly there was no moral code that went along with it. And, you know, I know a lot of guys who are like ex-athletes or something, and they'd go in and become stockbrokers. And they it wasn't that they were up late at night worrying about the best interest of their clients. That's for sure. I guess just the obvious counter response is, but, you know, it's the invisible hand, Jeff, and it doesn't matter what their motivations were. Doesn't laissez-faire capitalism lead everyone to do what's in the, you know, the social interest? So, I mean, is that, do you have any thoughts on, are we naive for talking like that, even because it's so far removed from reality that these are so hyper-regulated, or even if they weren't, just that in the real world, you just realize it's not what the textbook says? Or I'm just curious your thoughts on that issue.
Well, private equity firms are a little closer to the rub than banks, because I think they are less likely to get bailed out. Of course, Lehman didn't. Other investment firms were bailed out. But a pure private equity firm that has no real banking focus doesn't have protection against its own losses. So it's a creature of the market in that sense. But here's how private equity is not a creature of the market. And it's very significant. I mentioned earlier that a lot of deals were done with multiple parts debt to just one part equity. I think that is very artificial. I think in a world where the ability to borrow money was based largely on how much people saved and put into banks, I think that interest rates would be higher. And I think a lot of deals would be getting done with less debt. I don't think that a lot of the M&A activity, which goes on even today, and again, we're back in terms of pure deal volume, we're back at record highs in the last couple of years. Not the mega deals, the multi-billion dollar deals, the AOL Time Warners, those aren't as prominent today, but those sort of mid-market deals are still very, very hot. And I think that there'd be fewer of them if we didn't have so much financial engineering. And I think the heart of financial engineering is led by central banks. That's my very strong opinion, that central banks are, you know, skew things by making the cost of borrowing money artificially cheap. So when the cost of capital is low, all kinds of things look good on paper. That's the thing. And whether they actually turn out to be good 3 or 5 or 10 years later is the risk. And so I think it's tough as libertarians to argue against cowboy capitalism, because we're constantly saying, well, there's so many layers to the onion. You know, we've never had real free markets, et cetera. We end up sounding a lot like the people who say, well, we've never had real socialism. And it's not easy, but I think we have to keep making the case. And I think we're the only ones making the case that money itself is rigged, and thus lending itself is rigged. The value of money is rigged. It's not a market phenomenon. The left and the right don't say that. They say slightly different things about central banking. And some people on the left go so far as to call for the Treasury through Congress to run money directly, the greenbackers, without any Fed. But for the most part, the left and the right are arguing over mechanisms or rules for the Fed, not the core issue. So I think it's a great place for libertarians to stand out.
Well, and I think Austro-libertarians in particular, because you're right. I mean, that's one of the standard things when people ask me, you know, oh, what's the difference between the Chicago School and the Austrians? You guys are both anti-Keynesian, right? And one of the big obvious examples is when it comes to money and banking, and to explain, you know, the differences there. Let me ask you, so you made a reference to Ron Paul, so obviously we definitely want to get into that chapter of your life or that aspect of it, but I guess the background would be, how did you get into libertarianism itself? Like, what you mentioned that, I guess, at least when you were in college, you already, did you call yourself a libertarian at that point?
I did. I even called myself a big L libertarian. And I had, if any of your viewers are over 40, they might, or your listeners over 40, they might remember there used to be an old blue and white bumper sticker that said, legalize freedom, vote libertarian. And I had that on my 1989 Volkswagen Golf. So I remember that vividly. But really, it was because of my dad and because of my older brother. My older brother was getting Reason Magazine way back in the late 80s. I think that magazine first started publishing around 1977. So it's been around a long time. And my dad had I had The Road to Serfdom in the house. So that was one of the first books I read. I think my brothers had some Ayn Rand books. And my mother wasn't real thrilled about that because she thought Ayn Rand's atheism was a dark thing to which her young son should not be exposed. But nonetheless, I was. And so really, there was no brilliance on my part. It was, I have to credit my older brothers, really, or my older brother in particular, with just sort of stumbling into it. And the first presidential election in which I could vote was 88. And I met some friends who were involved in the Ron Paul campaign. One of them's name is Joe Becker. Some of your listeners might know that name, who was a student later of Murray Rothbard's at UNLV. One of them was Kent Snyder, who unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago, but he was Ron Paul's campaign manager a couple different times. So I knew them somewhat through the Libertarian Party and otherwise, and I went as a college undergraduate. I went and saw Dr. Paul at a Ramada Inn in the city of Orange, California. I'm not sure if that's a Ramada Inn anymore. It's kind of run down even then. And he came and talked. And, back then, there were no cell phones. There was no email. You had to kind of find out that a libertarian event was happening in your town via the local LP or via some sort of print newsletter. Or there used to be, if I recall, sometimes there would be notices in Liberty Magazine, which was a periodical to which I had subscribed for a while. So it was really neat to meet him back then. And I've stayed in touch with him ever since. So I've known him a long time.
It is amazing. I do remember, like, when you would get physical things in the mail and you were so excited to be able to read something. And like, now that seems so quaint and crazy to have to wait on the mail delivery.
Yeah.
Youngsters don't realize how good you have it nowadays. So I guess that's the natural transition then. So how did you end up working for Ron Paul and reaching such a high level of involvement with him?
Well, I wouldn't call it high level. I call it involved, certainly. But again, through Joe Becker. Joe Becker was another friend of Ron's, an economist. And he had, when Dr. Paul had decided that he wanted to return to Congress in 1996, some various people got involved in the 95 campaign. I wasn't one of them. Campaign for Congress, mind you, in South Texas. And when he won that election and came back in the beginning of 1996, he hired a few different people, and Joe Becker was one of them. So through Joe, I had kept up a little bit with what was going on in the congressional office. I wasn't really prepared to leave California or leave lawyering at the time, but we stayed in touch. And over the years, and at one point, an opportunity came up and I just said, I'm single. I don't have any kids. Why not? So I went and did that for a little bit.
Are there any things that stand out? Like, did your view of the political system change at all because of that experience?
Oh, absolutely. It was very, very interesting. If people don't understand the degree of inertia that exists in Washington, D.C., the people who just live there year after year after year and don't come and go and can't really be fired. Of course, federal employees have a union, which is very, very strong. And there's just a tremendous amount of people in Washington, D.C. making pretty good middle class or upper middle class salaries with great benefits and lots of time off and no stress. I mean, very, very little stress. And so, that was eye opening, but especially the members of Congress themselves. When I got there, there was still a sense, and it has really faded since, but there was still a sense, let's say in the 2000s, where a senator was on a higher level than a U.S. representative. Senators were more genteel. They had more of an Ivy League feel to them. They were perhaps better educated, perhaps better spoken, that the Senate was really a different animal, and that a lot of House members didn't, ultimately become senators. That's really changed, for one. I think the Senate, not that it was ever moral place, but it was certainly a more high-minded place 20 or 30 years ago. No question about that. But the other thing was just that the members of Congress are really, really mediocre people. I mean, the idea that we don't send a lot of high-achieving, wealthy people to Congress necessarily. A lot of them get rich once they arrive. But, you know, a lot, you have to imagine who's your typical congressman or congresswoman. A lot of times they were like the kid from your junior high who wanted to be on student council. And so it's somebody in your town or your county who would go to those boring meetings every Tuesday night to talk about some zoning issue or some irrigation issue or something really boring. And then they would just stick to that enough to become a city councilman or a woman, and then they'd stick to that long enough to become a state rep. I mean, that's really kind of the process by which a lot of people get elected, because you have to have name ID. So when someone comes along who doesn't have a political past, they have to be somebody like a Jesse Ventura or Donald Trump, who's got not a name ID, or a Glenn Jacobs. Now sometimes that can be circumvented by being a well-known local business person. Let's say you've got your name on a bunch of car dealerships or something like that. But for the most part, there's still this kind of paying your dues, plodding along, that gets people ultimately elected into the House. And so one of the great misconceptions in the American mind is that these House committees, which have jurisdiction over particular bills, are made up of people who have expertise over those areas. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, first you got to step back and say, look, the Constitution doesn't really lay out all these dopey committees. It just says the House and the Senate can operate according to the rules that they make. Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, those rules came out that said whichever party has more members, and the parties aren't mentioned in the Constitution, but whichever party has more members in the House, for example, gets to control everything that happens in that committee, the schedule, the bills that come before it, when those bills then go to the House floor for a full vote. So that's all kind of an extra constitutional process, which we've swallowed as part and parcel of how things work. And it's not supposed to be how things work. But the other thing is that, take the banking committee, for example, upon which Ron sat for so many years, that became the Financial Services Committee. People on that committee didn't have any particular expertise in banking. The whole process by which you get on a committee is based on how much seniority you have in the House, for one, and two, how much money you raise for the national committee. So you're supposed to take your own campaign funds and give some of those to either the DNC or the RNCC. And the more money you give to the national committees, the more plum committee assignments you get yourself. And so it becomes sort of a self-perpetuating system, because if you don't have opponents at home and you have a good, safe district because of gerrymandering, you can raise money and you don't really need to spend it because you don't have much of a race. So you take your extra money and you give it to the party, and you give more and more each year, so you move up in committee assignments. As you move up in committee assignments and get on more important committees like Ways and Means, for example, more and more lobbyists are interested in you because you have newfound power to affect legislation, which they care about very much. So they're going to give you more money as a result. So it really is a rich get richer system. As you get more influence, it gets easier to raise money. As you have more money, you gain influence because you become more of a kingmaker by giving lots of money to the party and everything. So, you know, people like to think that it's like House of Cards and Kevin Spacey. It's really much more boring than that. And people aren't as good looking as whatever Kevin Spacey's wife, I think it's Sean Penn's ex-wife, is on that show. It really is more mundane than that, but it's more like something inexorable. It kind of grinds forward, as opposed to having this nefarious conspiratorial purpose behind it. It really is just a lot of dull self-interest. At the end of the day, people want to stay elected. Lobbyists want to keep whatever perks their industry has. And so a lot of what we imagine as intrigue in D.C. is actually just pretty dull, Bob, at the end of the day.
So can you give us an idea, like what's the hierarchy, like some really low prestige committees versus, is the highest the Ways and Means, or are there ones that are even more lucrative than that?
I would say appropriations and Ways and Means would be the two juiciest plum assignments in the House. I can't speak for the Senate as much. So, you know, the appropriators, there's various subcommittees in the Appropriations Committee, and those subcommittees are supposed to pass every year 12 standalone appropriations bills that fund all the various agencies and departments of the U.S. government. And so in the old days, when things were not quite as nasty in Washington, the House would get together and pass the 12 bills, and the Senate would get together and pass its own 12 bills. And then the two sides would get together and have what's called a reconciliation bill. And then each one of those 12 bills would be voted upon by both the House and the Senate and then signed or rejected by the president. So that's back in the Mayberry days. But starting about 20 years ago, just the amount of partisanship in Washington really has come to kill that process. And a lot of that process happens in the summer. And now, as it bleeds over into the fall, members of Congress want to get back home to campaign, especially in the House where you got to run every 2 years. It never ends. They have to raise money and run constantly. So that process has really broken down. And that's been bad for the American people because what it's allowed to happen is these giant bills are getting packaged together. Sometimes they're called a minibus bill, and that's where you take two or three or four of the 12 appropriations bills and package them into one. And sometimes they're called an omnibus bill, where you take all 12 of them and package them into one gigantic bill. And when it comes to the gigantic ones, of course, members of Congress are not overseeing this. They don't know what's in it. The committee staffers are making all kinds of little arrangements with lobbyists, and stuff is getting stuck into these bills. Imagine some thousands and thousands of pages of bills, and then you look on page 578, section 6, little I, VV1, you know, shall be changed to may. And all of a sudden that means that, you know, that little technical language change means something great for the solar industry or who knows. So it really, really, the amount of transparency has declined precipitously. And what's so odd about this, of course, now, unlike 30 years ago, we have the internet. And instead of having to have someone type a bill and then photocopy it and send it around to all the members' offices, you just press send and you send an email. And a process that ought to be getting more transparent for the American people, which is the annual spending process, is actually getting less so. So it's it really is another symptom of how we're so politicized and we're so focused, for instance, on the culture wars and the social issues. But the big enchilada is getting baked right under our noses, and we don't pay much attention or talk much about it.
Is there some specific thing that you can point to? Like, why is that? You're saying how it's, you know, worse now than it was 20 years ago. Has it just been a gradual evolution? Is the standards change and they just keep becoming more and more brazen with it? Or is there some specific thing you can point to and say, oh yeah, there was this particular change and that's what opened the floodgates?
Boy, it's hard to say. The internet's probably been a big one because prior to that, you know, votes were not much known. How you're a member of Congress voted. I mean, most people today still don't bother to look, but you could. And you could very easily. You know, in the past, you might have had to rely on your local paper to announce how your congressperson or senator voted on something. And even then, they probably only publicized the big votes on, you know, on a big momentous bill, not the day-to-day mundane stuff. So now anybody can go to the Thomas, the Library of Congress website and look at the roll call votes every day. You can see how your member voted. And also, I just think the stakes have gotten higher, so people care more. Government, I think, has grown exponentially. You know, obviously, it grows nominally in size. Every year's budget is larger than the last. I think it grows in scope. There's new departments and agencies. But beyond that, I think it's just grown in power. I think it's and as a result of that, more people are interested in running for office. More people want to be involved. As the turf grows, there's more competition to be part of the gang that controls it. So it's really been, it's kind of mirrored what I'm sure our parents and grandparents would tell us is the politicization of everything in America. We don't necessarily agree on some of the things that we think we agree on. And I guess that shows up in Congress. But, you know, when the press knows everything and your local paper can print everything, and then social media, of course, can boost everything very quickly, people get a lot more interested in partisanship than comity with the other party or the other body.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the federal apparatus getting more powerful and things being qualitatively different, that there was a big deal with what the Fed did in the fall of 2008 and beyond. Yeah, I have an article where I called Ben Bernanke the FDR of central banking, meaning like he took that opportunity to really just expand the scope of what was considered acceptable. And when you're saying how these people in Congress, the public kind of just assumes, well, gee, if you're on the, you know, banking committee, you must know about there. I don't know if this was on your radar, Jeff, but apparently in September of 2008, when the Fed took over AIG, I think it was like for $85 billion or something like that. And they had a meeting, and apparently the way it was reported that in this meeting there was somebody from Congress, some name, I don't want to say names because I might have the wrong person and I don't want to falsely attribute it to somebody, but somebody that you would think was a real mover and shaker and nobody's fool in the House of Representatives apparently said to Bernanke, oh, do you have $85 billion to be able to do that? Like, like just didn't realize, like, no, that's not how it works here. And it's kind of, it was kind of cute that they were at least thinking, well, yeah, I mean, you got to go borrow it. You know what I mean? They could spend money they didn't have, but they meant, you know, from the Congress point of view, you have to at least go borrow it. You can't just create it with the mere act of spending it. So that was funny how they, even that person was not, didn't really get the full brunt of what central banking nowadays is capable of. Well, I think the natural next step here, just in you explaining your background, is you're currently the president of the Mises Institute. So do you want to give any detail as to, you know, how did you make that transition to this part now of your career?
Well, in short, I made it because in the last 10 or 15 years, I got to know Lou Rockwell. And, you know, our relationship developed because of that. But the move down here to Auburn and working for the Mises Institute was not something I had planned. I had planned to go back after 2012 and working for Ron for a few years. I had planned to go back to the M&A world. And I had accepted a job and I was getting ready to go back to the M&A world when Lou called me. And that was something, you know, I thought long and hard about. But I think part of it is just that this is the great part is that even though I'd been to Mises conferences and, of course, I'd been a small donor and that sort of thing over the years, I didn't realize really what I was getting into. And that probably helped because if I had known, my God, you know, just all the stuff that comes with it. It's just so funny, the various factions and all the different kinds of libertarians and all the different kinds of Austrians and all the different views of pragmatism versus, ideological purity and all the different things. I mean, it's funny, and I know that a lot of your listeners know what I'm talking about, but it's just it's amazing how much friendly fire there is out there. And I haven't been blameless in that either. I'm part of it, and I get it. But it's really been a blast, and I think that If nothing else, because the Mises Institute exists and because it has existed for 35 odd years now, a lot of people have come to read Hayek and Menger and Mises and Rothbard. If nothing else, I think that is a very, very, very important achievement. Obviously, I'd like to think we've had a bigger impact than that, but you know, nonetheless, really the fact that Mises had been thrown over by academia, treated shabbily, and was really at risk of becoming obscure after his death. And I'm very glad that that didn't happen, that that wasn't allowed to happen, that a lot of people, not just the Mises Institute, of course, that a lot of people took steps to, you know, put him in his rightful place as an economist of the 20th century. And today, I would argue that even his biggest critics on the left progressive side or on the Keynesian side or on the monetarist side or the neoliberal side, however you want to slice it, would acknowledge that he was a giant in his field. And that's a big achievement. And the fact that so much material has been able to be placed online, I think, is a big achievement. Have Austrians been too dogmatic for their own good? Have we hurt or helped? Well, I think overall we've helped. I think that there's a lot more knowledge and understanding of things like business cycles today. I think Bitcoin is a direct reflection of Hayek's idea of denationalized money, money created apart from a state. And I think it also flows from the work of Menger and Mises. I think you could call that an application of Austrian thought or principles. I think that the overall intellectual environment in academia, is as bad as we think it is in econ departments, really, it's a lot better than it was 100 years ago. I mean, people forget that after Keynes's general theory came out, after the Great Depression, after some of the New Deal programs of the 30s, not just economic, but social science departments across America were very left Marxist. People thought that capitalism was the past and that some variant of socialism was the future and that this was just scientific, that this was going to happen. And of course, I think in part because of the hard work of a lot of people across the spectrum. You know, we had Barry Goldwater came along, and ultimately the Reagan Revolution, and at least rhetorically, maybe not in terms of policy, but at least in terms of rhetoric, free markets and capitalism have enjoyed a renaissance amongst thinkers. And I think we can prove that today by looking at the dominant neoliberal strain that predominates the left. I think democratic socialism is a rising area of the left, but nonetheless, I would still say neoliberalism dominates, and neoliberalism accepts a lot of market capitalism. People like Bono are out there talking about how markets, yes, do make societies richer. So we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which our critics nonetheless give us some grudging acceptance. And that they accept a role of markets. And I'm not sure that that would have been the case 100 years ago. So there has been progress, and it sometimes is slow going. And sometimes we think that the world looks pretty bleak, but I would argue that it looks a lot less bleak than it has for many, many years. And we couple this with the fact that there's a digital revolution now that makes the transmittal of information very, very cheap, almost free, instantaneous, worldwide. And as long as we have that power, we have a tremendous leveling tool against everything that's arrayed against us. And we shouldn't sleep on that. And we should wake up in the morning and take cheer.
Yeah, I mean, just my own personal observations on that. I agree with you entirely that we tend to get dissatisfied. You always want more, and any minor setback in the current struggle is construed as, a catastrophe. But yeah, when you just step back and look at the broad sweep of things, like I remember I was in high school and I got my, I found Rothbard, and then I finally got Human Action, and I read that. I didn't understand it fully, but I did read it in high school, and I went to Tour Hillsdale College because that's where Mises' library was. And I think it was Gary Wolfram was there. He was an economics professor, and he was talking about Mises, and I was like, oh, because I had been saying it Mises, because I literally had not met another person who knew who this guy was. And so I had been mispronouncing it for years. And I remember the first time I went to the Mises Institute, being in a room with other people who had all, read the work of Mises. Like, I was so excited that, oh, wow, there's a whole room full of people who've heard of this guy. So, I mean, to go from that to now where, people on the internet take pot shots at the Austrians, at least they're mocking us. Before, they literally didn't even know who we were. So that is progress in that respect, to be sure. So, I mean, it seems to me, Jeff, that it's on the one hand, it seems like, oh, wow, now that we can communicate this information, like victory is inevitable, like because we're so sure. I mean, this stuff seems so logical to us. And it's not like because we have really idiosyncratic value systems, it's kind of like, yeah, if you don't like poverty, if you don't like business cycles, if you don't like mass murder and war, and you don't need the state for all these other alleged things, let alone roads, but these things that people think you need it for. So it's like, it's kind of like, well, why then hasn't it swept the world? Is it that people just... Anyway, what are your thoughts on that? Because you keep thinking like, oh, geez, once we can just crank this information out, everybody can see it. And we got videos and we got real eloquent spokespeople who can make the case in a very pithy manner. You might have thought that, yeah, this is just 8 more years and that's it. And everyone's going to be a libertarian. And that doesn't seem to be true.
Well, first, to a limited extent, markets have swept the world. Despite their biggest critics, people everywhere like stuff. People everywhere want to have Diet Coke and an iPhone and a Honda Accord. They don't all have it yet, but they want it. And that wanting is an awfully tough thing to suppress in the digital age. It's awfully hard to get people to stop talking to each other. I understand places like North Korea, there's no communications. Places like China tries to limit it. But boy, it's awfully hard to suppress the natural human desire of billions of people around the world who want to wake up every morning and better their economic and material circumstances. I mean, that is, at the end of the day, what drives everything, not making good arguments or getting people to read books or anything else. And I know Stephen Kinsella's talked about this. He says a libertarian revolution is not going to come across necessarily because we convinced anyone. It's going to come across about because of technology and because of superior products and superior services and that sort of thing. I think there's a lot of truth to that. So, why what we consider almost a self-evident or obvious philosophy when it comes to a way of looking at economics and when looking at government, why hasn't this swept the world? I think there's a couple theories on that. One is something that Doug Casey says, where maybe there's actually a DNA or genetic component to liberty-minded people. There's some sort of twist somewhere in our background that makes us see the world this way and think this way. And progressives have a different twist, because I think most progressives think that their own worldview, and by progressive, I mean on left and right, people who think that humans need to be perfected to better serve the state. Not necessarily, I'm not using progressive necessarily in the left-wing sense of the word, but just people who want us to evolve into a better man. I think that they think their own worldview is moral, and that it's self-evident and obvious, and that libertarianism is a bizarre philosophy that would bolster corporate interests and create a dog-eat-dog society and provide no social safety nets, and that it would be a terrible society. So we have to understand that people don't look at this sort of thing necessarily intellectually, and they aren't necessarily convinced by arguments. They have to feel it viscerally. And that's why, for example, people who have lived in former truly unfree countries like the former Soviet Union, like Yuri Maltsev and Dr. Liliana Stern, who's across the street, a professor at Auburn, you know, they really feel it viscerally. And so when they look at America, they say, you got nothing to complain about. You're ridiculous for even talking about or entertaining socialism, even if you're hyphenating it with democratic socialism. And that you guys don't know how good you have it. And that's true. I think that an awful lot of people in the West have never known real hardship. We've always had hot and cold running water. We've always had electricity at our fingertips. We haven't really had to worry about food. We've always had some kind of, let's say, reasonable vehicle. And we, you know, as a result of all that, it's easy to get complacent, and it's easy to imagine that the material wealth around us will just grow on trees and it'll organize itself regardless of the incentives or lack of incentives or counter incentives put in place by a Bernie Sanders government. You know, we think that's not true, but more importantly, we think that's worth fighting against, that you can call it materialism if you want, and you can be dismissive of the prosperity around us and say, well, that's not the most important thing. You know, people need a sense of home or feeling or caring or whatever. And yeah, okay, I get that. There's more to life than stuff. But when you look at things like modern healthcare, when you get modern dentistry, I had a root canal recently, and believe you me, I was very glad to get it. But, you know, when you look at the ease of communication and transport, when you look at cheap and abundant energy, cheap and abundant food in the West relative to most people's to median incomes, I mean, these are tremendous advances, and this isn't just materialism. This isn't just somebody playing a game on their iPhone. I mean, we're talking about, you know, life with leisure and life with seeking higher meaning, something other than just a struggle for economic survival, which life was for virtually everyone up to just a couple hundred years ago in the West. You know, that's important, and that's worth fighting for. And, you know, I think that understanding why people see things differently is important, but maybe we had to start with understanding that they have the luxury of seeing things differently because we're starting off in a rich society. And that's why we have the time to have arguments about the Mises Institute, mm-hmm. because we're not subsistence farming all day. So let's not kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Let's understand that this could all go away.
Well, I think I agree with everything you're saying there. You said I heard you at one conference, I'm going to not make it as eloquent as you said it, but it was along the lines of, you know, lots of progressives who probably generally hate capitalism and big business. When they take their first ride in Uber, all of a sudden they're going to be against the taxi cab monopoly. Like, and it's not because, you know, of some eloquent argument they heard from a libertarian about open entry. They're just going to see with their own eyes, wow, this is much better on numerous dimensions. And that's how you're going to make that person a supporter of, you know, the right of Uber and Lyft to come into their cities. So I definitely agree with that. I guess my only concern is like with something like healthcare or the recent financial crisis, that, yeah, the Americans, they don't need to, it's not about, you know, pointy head academics tell them something. They know with their own eyes that, whoa, something really screwy happened. My home price was way up and then it crashed and now I have to postpone retirement and I don't like that. But you know, isn't there, I mean, there's some intellectual element there where they have to know why did that happen. And if they're being told, oh, that's because there was deregulation in the late 90s and that's what free market capitalism is, then they're going to support Elizabeth Warren. So I guess that's my only mild pushback to what you were just saying there, that, you know, there still seems like they have to realize what is it that's generating these good outcomes. And yeah, they can say pure socialism doesn't seem to work, but gee, we tried laissez-faire capitalism under George W. Bush and that blew up in our faces.
Yeah, and that's true. A lot of people absolutely think that. And that's, I think, our job number one is to fight back against that. There's no question about it, because look, it's no crime not to understand the financial crisis of 2008. There are plenty of PhD academic economists who don't understand what happened in the financial crisis of 2008 and say preposterous, silly things about what caused it. So we have to give the American people some slack on that. They're busy people and they don't have all day to read Bob Murphy's blog, let's say. So that's why we have to do a better job of being more visceral, of being more immediate, of being more gut level in our messaging. And I think liberty-minded people are getting better at that. I think we're improving. And there's so much at stake. That's what, you know, at the end of the day, there's so much at stake. And we can't do nothing. We know that. We have to do something. So that means we ought to try to figure out how to do something better than we're doing it now.
And that's exactly what you and everyone associated with the Mises Institute is trying to do to educate Americans and people around the world is the benefits of free markets and really understand how the market economy works. And of course, what better place to start than with the classics in Austrian economics? Well, Jeff, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And I just point everyone to Mises.org. That's Mises.org to see the fine work that you and the other folks at the Mises Institute are putting out. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
Thank you, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.